for more details. Start with the motivation. So sort of the main motivation for my main motivation for studying this class of problems was the observation that the conformal bootstrap equations place very strong constraints on the CFT data of interacting conformal field theory. So this is a schematic depiction of the conformal bootstrap equation. And it has been demonstrated mostly numerically that it leads to strong constraints on various scaling dimensions and OP coefficients in interacting conformal field theories. But so far, the precise analytic origin of these constraints, and especially the constraints on scalar operators, is still rather mysterious. So we have some very powerful numerical machinery that gives us these beautiful plots and bounds on scaling dimensions, but we don't really understand too well analytically how these constraints come about, but there are some hints of an underlying structure of the procedure, which appeared in a paper of David Simon Duffin last year. So to summarize it, I would like to understand the origin of these constraints analytically and a related motivation comes from studying quantum field theory in ABS space. So the idea is that every time you take some UV complete quantum field theory and put it in D plus one dimensional antidesiderator space, so it's some D plus one dimensional QFT, assuming that you also put an SO, the conformally invariant boundary condition, then this setup is going to define for us some conformally invariant D dimensional theory on the boundary. So this is just holographic. This proposal was taken seriously in the non-gravitational setting for the first time by these gentlemen. And the usual holographic dictionary still holds. So local operators on the boundary, in the boundary theory, corresponds to states in the Hilbert space of the theory in ADS. And you can think about the conformal bootstrap constraints for the theory of the boundary as being essentially the analogous to the S-matrix bootstrap of the quantum field theory in the bound. So somehow, what is S-matrix bootstrap in flat space becomes conformal bootstrap once you put the theory in ADS. Okay. And quite conveniently, the ADS acts as a nice IR regulator. It has a maximal spacetime symmetry, and the continuum of multiparticle states that we have in flat space gets resolved into a discrete set of operators. So somehow the analytic properties of this ADS setup are slightly nicer than the analytic properties of the setup in flat space of the usual S. And as an added bonus, when there happens to be a stress tensor in the boundary theory, we are actually describing a theory of quantum gravity in the bound. So as a byproduct, this setup actually knows everything about all quantum gravity theories which can be placed in antidesiderator space. Well, sort of the natural questions you can ask here is, we know that every bulk theory is going to give us some conformal boundary theory, but you can ask the converse question, namely whether every boundary theory in some way arises from a bulk theory. So this question was asked for the first time by these gentlemen, and they found an affirmative answer in some limited setting. And going even further, we can ask whether we can use the boundary bootstrap to solve in some limited way the bulk theories. So are there any questions about the motivation for setup? Let me tell you a little bit about what is known about analytic conformal bootstrap up to date. So the main success story happened in 1984 when Belavin, Polyakov, and Zamolochikov in a seminal paper solved completely all unitary two-dimensional CFTs with central charge between 0 and 1. But the story in a general dimension, or when the central charge in 2D is greater than 1, is much less understood. In general, almost all the analytic progress has in one way or another followed from constraints which arise in the Lorentzian regime. And by Lorentzian regime, I'm going to mean that some pairs of operators are nearly null or time-like separated. And essentially, perhaps the most important general result for conformal bootstrap generality has been derived last year by Simon Karan Uot. It is an inversion formula, which in an important way uses Lorentzian kinematics. And the physical content of this formula essentially is that the CFT data of exchanged operators with spin at least 2 in one channel are completely fixed by the singularity of the four-point function in the cross channel. And this formula led to a unification of many results, which were obtained quite arduously up until that point using a large spin expansion. And there's also a related set of results using a Reggie-like limit, which I will not have much to say about in this talk. So in this talk, I would like to take a more Euclidean perspective. So the reason is that somehow the expectation is that all the bootstrap constraints are already in principle captured by the correlator in the Euclidean regime. I mean, if you know the correlator in the Euclidean regime, when all the operators are space-like separated, then you can obtain the correlator in all the other kinematics by analytic continuation. And it is in the Euclidean regime when all the OP expansions converge, all the S, T, and U channel expansions converge. And up until now, all the evidence seems to indicate that actually all the physical constraints of bootstrap are already contained in the Euclidean regime, so when all the operators are space-like separated. In particular, numerical bootstrap works in this setup. You can think of the numerical bootstrap as being a machine which extracts for you the optimal constraints that arise in the Euclidean regime. And indeed, it has been also demonstrated in the same paper I already referred to before of David Simons-Duffin, that this Euclidean bootstrap knows essentially everything about the Lorentzian analytic bootstrap that I was talking about in the previous slide. But if you don't know details of this, don't worry. I'm going to explain everything as we go on. But certainly, it is a natural task to try to analytically extract the complete set of optimal constraints which arise in the Euclidean regime. So some of the optimal constraints that the numerical bootstrap can see. And in this talk, I'm going to solve this problem in one-dimensional conformal field theories, in the case when all the external operators are identical primaries. So as we go on, we are going to obtain a formalism which unifies the numerical bootstrap and the analytic Lorentzian bootstrap, at least in this context of 1D CFTs, where what exactly Lorentzian means is slightly unclear in one space-time dimension, but I'm going to be able to obtain from this formalism the same class of results as the people who are doing Lorentzian bootstrap in higher D magnitudes. And we'll see that this approach is very closely related to a recent approach of a group led by Gopa Kumar, which uses Polyakov's crossing symmetric unitary block. So it's essentially the same approach. It is a closely related approach to what I'm going to this. Okay, so in the rest of the talk, I'm going to stay in one space-time dimension. So let me set the stage and explain to you what conformal symmetry in 1D looks like. So the symmetry algebra is of the SL2R, 1D conformal group, or which is the same as SO1,2. It has three generators: translations denoted by P, dilatations, and special conformal transformations denoted by K. We will describe the theory in terms of the algebra of local operators, and in particular the whole vector space of local operators splits into highest weight representations of this algebra, and the highest weights are called primary operators. So in this case, well, K is like a lowering operator, P is a raising operator, and B is just a Cartan. So highest weight means it's killed by the lowering operator, by K. And the eigenvalue under the Cartan, the dilatations, is called the scaling dimension, and then with the delta. In 1D, there is no spin, so primary operators are completely characterized by their scaling dimension. And the whole theory, at least the local physics of the theory, is completely captured by the scaling dimensions and structure constants of the operator graph expansion of the operator algebra. As you probably know, conformal field theory is characteristic by the stress tensor being traceless. But if we are in one dimension, stress tensor is a traceless 1x1 matrix. In other words, it's a zero. It's a number which is equal to zero. So there is no stress tensor in a 1D CFT, or it's equal to zero. It's either topological or non-local. I'm not going to be talking about a topological case. I'm also about a non-local case. So somehow, yeah, the underlying fact is that a local theory must necessarily have a stress tensor, because in a local theory you must be able to deform the metric in a local way. So if there is no stress tensor, the theory is not local. But nevertheless, there are many interesting examples of such theories, even though stress tensor. Perhaps the most prominent of them are conformal boundaries, interfaces, and in general some line defects and higher dimensional CFTs. They're absolutely ubiquitous. Then recently there was a surge of interest on the so-called SYK model, and even though the original SYK model was not conformally invariant, the SL2R invariance was broken both spontaneously and explicitly. Gross and Rosenhaus actually defined a version that they call the conformal SYK model, which has an explicit, which has an exact SL2R invariance, and also that's an important assumption which I forgot to put on the slide, that there is a state in a Hilbert space which is invariant under the full SL2R. So for example, standard conformal quantum mechanics, so quantum mechanics with a 1 over R potential it doesn't satisfy this assumption, because there is no state in the Hilbert space which would be invariant under DPMK. But in this case, there is a state which is dual by a state operator map to identity operator. Okay. Finally, going back to one of my previous slides, another important example of such theories are non-gravitational two-dimensional quantum field theories placed in ADS2. So any UV complete 2D TFT is going to define for you a theory satisfying all these axioms. And finally, lastly, trivial tautological example is that you can just take your favorite higher dimensional conformal field theory, restrict all correlators to be on a line, and all the axioms are again going to be satisfied. So all the constraints which I can derive from this approach also apply to higher dimensional CFTs, although they are probably not optimal constraints. Okay, then what is the setup of the bootstrap? Well, we'll be in a 1D CFT. We'll look at a primary operator, which I'm going to denote phi. And to ease up the notation, the scaling dimension of this primary operator phi is going to be denoted by A during the rest of the talk. So that's important to remember, because A is going to be all over the place, and A is just the same as delta. We'll put you look at a four-point function of phi and put them on a line. Now in 1D there is only one cross ratio, so the four-point function is some function of a variable z, which is called the cross ratio, which takes this form in terms of the positions of the four operators. Xij is the difference of xi and xj, and because the four-point function can be discontinuous as we pass operators through each other, and in this case, when all the four operators are identical, it's actually permutation symmetric. It is sufficient. I mean, all the information is captured if we restrict z to be between 0 and 1. So you can put one operator at the origin, the other one at 1, and another one at infinity. And then the last operator, or the second operator, is going to be in between the first and third. So in other words, z is between 0 and 1. And that's where all the information about the bootstrap is. Okay, here's the four-point function. We take out, as usual, if you're familiar with conformal field theory, we take out a conformal covariant prefactor, which captures the transformation, the non-trivial transformation under conformal transformations, times g of z. G of z is, for the time being, an unknown, or in principle, unconstrained function of the cross ratio, even though, of course, in a concrete theory, it is a concrete function. Now we can take this four-point function and expand it in the OPE. So first of all, we can expand it in the S channel. That means taking the second operator near the third, near the first one, in a small z expansion. And the terms which appear in this expansion correspond to primary operators, which can appear in the OPE of phi with itself. And the contribution of a given conformal family, or of a given primary operator and all of its descendants, is captured by this function called a conformal block. So in 1D, the conformal block is a known function of the cross ratio, just some hypergeometric function. But what is really important is not so much the hypergeometric function as this z to the delta prefect. So the z to the delta essentially tells you that the first state which propagates in this contribution to the OP is a primary is an operator of dimension delta. So the powers of z count the energy, the scaling dimension. And then hypergeometric just dresses the z to the delta. It comes from all the other descendants. So we can expand the same four-point function in the t channel. This just means taking z close to one. Then, because the operator is identical, the operators which can appear in this OP are the same as in the S channel. But we are essentially exchanging the role of the operator one, x one and x three, which is the same as taking z to one minus z. You can check that if you take z and replace one and three, x one with x three, and keep x two and x four the same, then z is going to go to one minus z. And because there is some prefactor, we also get a prefactor of the transformation here. Now, an important point is that both of these expansions are convergent in the region when z is between 0 and 1. That they stop converging. One of them stops converging when we hit the boundaries of this interval. So this is the content of the bootstrap. The bootstrap is just the statement set these two expansions equal to each other. That's what I wrote here. I just rewrote it in a slightly different way. So on the left hand side we have the S channel, on the right hand side we have the T channel, and they must be the same. You should think about this as a constraint on the operators which appear in the OP, on the delta O's and C phi phi O squared. We can rewrite this constraint in the following way by taking everything to the same side. So now we are just summing over the operators in the OPE of c squared times the function f of z, which is just the difference of the S channel conformal block and the T channel conformal block. And the whole thing must be good. Now you should think about this equation as an equation in the sort of space of functions of the z variable, because for every z we get one constraint on the c's and deltas. And even though the original setup, as I described it, was valid for z being real and between 0 and 1, the equation actually makes sense in the complex z plane everywhere except for these two branch cuts. So there's a branch cut starting at z equals 0 going to the left, and branch cut starting at z equals 1 going to the right. But both the S and T channel expansion actually converge everywhere except for these two branch cuts. The equation holds there. So the equation, in some sense, lives in a vector space that I'm going to denote calligraphic U, vector space of functions, which are holomorphic in the blue region, because the blocks are certainly holomorphic, and also in the infinite sum, you don't lose holomorphicity. So you have a space of functions which are holomorphic in this region. They are antisymmetric under the z goes to one minus z, the crossing transformation. And also we should require that the behavior of these functions as we take z to 0, 1, or infinity is the same as that of physical four-point functions. So somehow it's a vector space which is generated by these functions f of z, but we also allow infinite sums. And the infinite sums that we allow are the same that sort of appear in the physical four-point functions. So sort of the asymptotic growth of OP coefficients in these infinite sums is the same as in physical four-point functions. This is just a technical detail which you can certainly ignore.
So you don't need to give the discontinuity?
No, I don't. Well, no, I don't really want to talk about discontinuity. The discontinuity is across the branch cut is a sort of a property which is at the border of the region of convergence, so it's a little bit subtle. Whether or not discontinuity is a good object to talk about depends on what you integrate discontinuity against. If it's something sufficiently soft, it's okay. Well, I would like to avoid talking about discontinuity.
This is unconstrained. In this vector space, you consider functions with any discontinuity at the branch.
Well, it is the discontinuities would be those discontinuities which can arise from infinite sums of these f of z. I don't really know much about it. I'm only constraining the f, the functions, by their behavior as equals to 0, 1, infinity, not along the branch. So, I just wrote down some equation, the bootstrap equation, but is it really constraining? We don't, well, I'm going to describe to you that, explain to you that it is. But before I do that, let me describe two very simple solutions of the of this equation. The solution with the sparsest possible spectra, which happen to be free, and making connection with my with the fact that NA QFT in ADS2 describes or gives rise to a CFT1, these solutions to crossing will correspond to free fields in ADS2. So the simplest free field in ADS2 is just a free massive scalar. So let's take a massive scalar of mass m phi. I put it in ADS2 of radius r. Then the corresponding boundary primary operator is some operator, let me call it phi, with dimension a, which is related to the mass using this famous ADS CFT formula related to Casimir's. The four-point function, so the four-point function of the phi, or maybe I can draw it, how you get it. So we are putting some field phi in ADS2, and we would like to compute the boundary four-point function. And the boundary four-point function is just given by the three possible contractions. So it's a three field. So it's, you get one contraction like that, another contraction like that, and the final one like that. So should have three channels. So that's why there are these three terms. One of them is just identity, and the other ones are as follows. We can take it and expand it in the S channel OPE, any OPE, and we'll find that besides identity, in the OPE of this phi and phi field, there's also an infinite tower of double trace operators with dimensions 2a plus 2n, so spaced by even integers. And the OPE coefficients is some mass ratios of gamma functions. Okay, we can do the same thing for the massive fermion. Again, there are three contractions, but one of them gets a minus sign because of the statistics of the fermion. And again, we can decompose the four-point function of this free fermion into identity and infinite power of double trace operators. So while for the boson, the double trace operators which appeared were roughly speaking phi and an even number of derivatives. The double trace operators which appear for the psi, for the fermion, it's going to be two particle states with two psi and an odd number of derivatives. So that's why the spectrum in this case is 2a plus 2n plus 1, so 2a plus odd integers. And again, the OP coefficients are some mass ratios of functions. Now, using this formalism that I'm going to introduce very soon, you can derive these OP coefficients extremely easily, but that's just sort of a trivial consequence. So now I would like to invite you to think about the sort of dual space, so the space of the crossing equation. So as I was saying, the crossing equation lives in some vector space of functions, and it is useful to think about the dual space of that, because let's take any element omega of the dual space. This would be some abstract element of dual space. Then let me define this function omega of delta to be the way that omega acts on the f of delta. Let me remind you, it's going to be useful for future reference. So f of delta was this. Is it okay if I write here? So f of delta was this crossing antisymmetric combination of conformal blocks. Yeah, this is really the most important function from the whole talk. Okay. Where g delta of z is z to the delta times 1 plus some subleading terms in g, which are captured by the hypergeometric. Okay. So let me now define for any omega in a dual space. Let me define a function omega of delta, some real function of delta, which is just the action of omega on this vector. right? Then we can apply this omega to the bootstrap equation and find a linear constraint on the OP coefficient. So now I'm going to just call c squared lambda for simplicity. You're going to find a linear constraint like that. So far, it's completely trivial what I'm saying. There's no physics at all. But an important goal of the analytic bootstrap is to identify some suitable basis for this dual space, to find some nice complete set of these functions, of these omegas. Now, what exactly does suitable mean? I mean, it could mean many different things. You could, for example, start by evaluating the bootstrap equation at various values of z. So this would correspond to omega just being the evaluation functional, which evaluates things at z. Okay, that's not very revealing. What people in numerical bootstrap do is that they typically look at linear combinations of derivatives with respect to z evaluated to 1/2. Well, this is extremely useful for the numerics. People can derive bounds and solve numerically the 3D Ising model using that. But it doesn't really give us much of an analytic handle on the problem. So what I'm going to mean by suitable or useful is a basis with the following property. It is a basis which, well, actually I'm going to construct two different bases, one for the free Fermi and one for the free boson. And these bases have the property that they are in some sense dual to these f of deltas. So f of deltas form in a sense a basis for the vector space V, and I'm going to construct a dual basis to this basis. But there is some small subtlety which I don't really want to go into too much, which is that, yeah, sorry, I should say that a basis is formed by f of deltas when the deltas are restricted to the spectrum of the free fermion or to the free boson. So it's a discrete set of f's of these functions. Except the f's are not quite a complete set. We also need to supplement it with the derivatives with respect to delta. So you need f of delta n and the derivative. Whereby by this partial f in the rest of the talk, I always mean derivative with respect to delta. Okay. Now, why this is reasonable is going to have hopefully transpire soon.
Yes. Is it clear why we need one derivative? Why we need an derivative with respect to delta? Why no third derivative?
Well. Yeah, well, using this formalism, you can actually prove that all the other derivatives can be expressed in this basis. That's an answer. But somehow a better answer to that is that in the case when the external dimensions are not equal, actually the basis is going to, the basis consists of this may be a side comment, but somehow the derivative gets resolved into the other double trace operator. So in general, if you have a four-point function of four non-identical operators, then there are two kinds of double trace operators which can appear in the S channel. There are things like O1, O2, N, which have scaling dimension delta 1 plus delta 2 plus 2N. And there are the other operators whose scaling dimension is delta 3 plus delta 4 plus 2N. And only when there is the coincidence when all the operators are the same, then actually this set of deltas is the same as this set of deltas, so they collide, and that's why you need the derivative. But in the general case, you will just need f's corresponding to the union of these two spectra. I mean, it's the same spectrum which can appear in the contact diagram. I'm gonna get to that. And a nice thing about this basis is that all the elements of these bases are in some sense extremal functions. So this notion of extremal functional was first discussed by Shir El-Shouk and Miguel Pavlosh. And these extremal functions are very sort of the reason why numerical conformal bootstrap works. So this is somehow the reason why this formalism is connecting the numerical bootstrap and the Lorentzian analytic bootstrap. But the one important upshot of this is that having this basis for the dual space is going to allow us to study deformations of the theories of the free Fermion and free boson. We are going to discover some nice property or some exact results about such deformations. Okay, so now comes the rather technical part of the talk. for which I don't have much physical motivation. Just we tried really hard to construct a basis like this, and eventually we succeeded. I'm sure there is some underlying physics which we haven't yet discovered, perhaps related to some complete wave functions in ADS. But we are not quite there yet. So you'll have to bear with me and just hear what the technical details are, maybe. So the functionals which I would like to consider, instead of evaluating at z, they take the form of some integral kernel. So omega acting on some test function, some telegraph, some general anti-symmetric f, has as two pieces. The first piece is what I already showed here. It's a contour integral which starts at 1/2 goes to 1. It's enough to take it from 1/2 to 1 because of anti-symmetry. F is always anti-symmetric, so we don't need it to take from 0 to 1, just from 1/2 to 1. But this actually, if we consider just functionals like this, we wouldn't get a complete set. And what we need to do, I don't know why, but it just works, and it works rather remarkably, is to supplement it with another piece, which is a contour that runs from 1/2 and goes up to infinity. Yeah, if you can explain to me where this comes about, I would be really delighted. Also, the sign that we take is going to depend on the basis that we are constructing. So remember that the whole point of this is to construct two dual bases, one for the bosons, one for the fermions, and the two signs are our respective signs here. The functional is fixed by some integral kernel, h of z, and it appears as h of z here, and it appears in some transformed form over here. So just draw. From the point of view of the argument of h, the first integral is just over real z, and the second integral is on the unit circle, because when z is on this contour, then the argument of the second h lies on the unit circle. That's very okay. Now, actually, not for every h do you get a consistent functional. You don't always get a consistent element of this dual space. There are some constraints on this h, which essentially come from the constraints on the asymptotic behavior of the original functions. Okay, this is all a bit technical. Let me just write it here. So one constraint is that h near 1 must be power law suppressed in a way that depends on the external scaling dimension A. And the second constraint is that h must satisfy this functional equation, which relates two points on the unit circle. Okay. And now if in addition h satisfies another functional equation, then it's possible to transform this complicated looking double contour prescription to a more compact formula. So let me first write this third functional equation for future reference. We're not going to use it, but it's equal to plus. Just the important thing is to know that for this whole thing to be consistent, h is very tightly constrained, and some of the solutions of these constraints are going to produce the basis for us. Okay, so if h satisfies these constraints, it's possible to transform the action here to transform the action of omega on these vectors into the following form, and this is already a much more suggestive form because of the prefactor. So this prefactor somehow arises from the phases that the conformal block has, the z to the delta, when you sit on top of the branch cut. But so when the sign is positive, we get 1 minus cos of this parameter, of this argument, which is a function. You should think about it as a function of delta. So this as a function of delta has double zeros at the spectrum of the free boson theory, right? So the whenever delta is 2a plus even integers, then this prefactor has double zeros. And the only way that these double zeros can disappear is if this integral after it has some poles, which is precisely what's going to happen. So this, you can maybe ignore this. This is some technical slide, but what you should take from it is that it's possible to define functionals in such a way that the action of the functional on these vectors naturally has double zeros, either on the spectrum of the generalized of the free scalar or of the free fermion, when it's depending on the sign. So now let's specialize to the fermionic sign. So in that case, the previous formula can be simplified to this. So here it's completely manifest that there are some double zeros at the free fermion spectrum. In particular, when delta is 2a plus of integers, the cos squared has a double zero. And we can try to solve those functional equations for h. Well, the solutions of these functional equations can be classified by their small z behavior, and there are two infinite classes of these of solutions. One infinite class which goes like a power law z to the -2 and -2, where m is a positive non-negative integer, and the other one which has an additional law. Okay, so here comes the most important technical point, which is that we have the cos squared in front, but now because our kernel h of z has some singularity as we take z to zero, there could be additional singularities coming from this integral. So in the integral, we are integrating from 0 to 1 dz, and now when there is some singular behavior in the h, like 2n-2, we are acting on the conformal block, which has z to the delta -2a. So when we integrate this, we are going to produce a pole, which goes like delta minus 2a plus 2m plus 1. Right? So now we have a simple pole in delta, and this simple pole makes the double zero into a simple zero. And when we have a log in addition to that, so imagine we had a log here, then we would make this into a double pole. I don't think everybody can see that, but an additional log is going to make this into a double pole. So that's going to cancel this double zero completely. Maybe I can stay here. I prefer to stay on the other side, sorry. So in other words, we found two infinite sets of functionals or of kernels which have the following behavior on the spectrum of the free fermion. They almost all of them have a double zero at all of them have a double zero at almost all the points in the spectrum. The functionals omega, which correspond to h's with a non-logarithmic power law behavior, vanish on the whole spectrum, and their first derivative is like a Kronecker delta. That's what I demonstrated before, because precisely when delta hits 2a plus 2m plus 1, the double zero is made into a simple zero, so we get this Kronecker delta-like behavior. And then there are the other functionals, which are like h of h hat, that have this extra logarithm. Those guys vanish on almost the whole spectrum, except for one point in the spectrum where the double zero is made into a, well, it's completely canceled and is made into a one. And their first derivative vanishes in the whole spectrum. So it is in this sense that this set of omegas is a dual basis for the basis of these f's and delta f's. These are the important equations. And in addition to that, it can be shown that these functionals form a complete basis for the dual space. So we found all the solutions of the functional equations, but you can actually go one step further. I don't have time to explain that, and demonstrate that all these H's somehow have all the information about crossing. That these functionals just contain everything there is to know about the bootstrap equation. In particular, the free fermion is crossing symmetric if and only if the OP coefficients, you can find the OP coefficients of the free fermion just by acting with omega at identity. That should be fairly obvious, because when you act with omega hat on the crossing equation, you'll only get two components, one coming from identity and one coming from the nth operator. So this allows you to fix one, assuming you know the H's, assuming you know these actions, you can fix the OP coefficients in a simple form. So let me maybe illustrate this in more concrete examples. Let's set the external dimension to be equal to 1/2. Then there is a closed formula for these kernels. In particular, they look like Legendre polynomials with odd order. You can find the action of these functionals on your f vectors. It looks like this. So as I said, when a is equal to 1/2, the spectrum of the free Feynman consists of even integers, 2, 4, 6, etc. And this is the first functional, which means it should have a simple zero at the first operator and double zeros everywhere else. And this function is completely fixed by the kinematics. I mean, it looks like a very complicated function, but it is the unique functional which has these properties. There is a unique functional which, if you act on with f of deltas, has these properties of having double zeros at a spectrum, and it is this function. This is not some arbitrary ugly function, but it's completely fixed. The connection to the usual numerical bootstrap is that this function omega zero proves that the free fermion maximizes the gap among all the unitary 1D solutions to the cross. Because if I act with it on a solution to the crossing, I must have at least one operator in the red region. Otherwise, I get a contradiction with unitarity. So this is the function which the numerical bootstrap constructs, the functional which is responsible for upper bounds on the spectrum. So of course, somehow the dream of analytic bootstrap or of this program is to construct analytic formulas for the functionals corresponding to interacting CFTs. Okay, any questions about the fermionic functionals?
So did you make progress there? Huh? Did you make progress? Last question.
About this, about the
last question.
Well, I think I'm going to comment on it a little bit more. Like, we have it was possible to make progress in 1D as well by deforming. You can study deformations of the free fermion or the free boson, and then you can look for the functions which are sort of dual to that new interacting theory. So that's one way to make progress. And another way to try to make progress is to go to higher D, where progress has been limited, but we are getting close. Okay, now as I said, we can use these functions to study deformations of the free fermion, for example, in this case. So let's study a deformation. So let's start with the free fermion and suppose that we have some deformations of the free fermion with no new operators appearing. So the only thing that can change in this deformation is that the double trace operators, which are already there, get some anomalous dimensions and corrections to OP coefficients. So the deformed dimension as a function of the coupling G is just the undeformed one plus some first order correction, and the same thing for the OP coefficients. Now we impose crossing symmetry, and we apply this complete basis of functionals. First, we can apply the omega m's, expand to the first order in G, and what we find is that, well, the only contribution to the equation is, of course, coming just from this anomalous dimension, because the function vanishes on the whole spectrum, so it kills all the other terms except for a derivative of f here. So by that, we find that the anomalous dimension of the m operator must be zero. And when we do the same thing with omega hat, we find that the correction to OP coefficient must be zero. In other words, the free fermion admits no deformations which are consistent with crossing unless you introduce some completely new operators in the OP. This is sort of natural from the ADS point of view, because the only sort of UV complete deformation would be like a psi to the 4 interaction, but psi to the 4 vanishes because of the statistics. Psi to the 4 is just zero because psi is an anti-symmetric field. It's a fermionic field. And all the higher contact terms which have some derivatives in them, they will be irrelevant. They won't give you a UV complete theory. Now let's go to the bosonic functionals, where the story is more interesting, because there actually is a deformation. So we can repeat the same thing. Now double zeros come from the sine squared, and they can be canceled by some poles coming from this integral. The structure is exactly the same as before, except one function is missing. So in a sense, the omega zero that we had before doesn't exist. Or in yet other words, every functional which vanishes on the whole spectrum, so on this 2a plus even integers, must have at least two simple zeros. There is no functional which would have double zeros everywhere except for one place where it would have a simple zero. So now the complete basis consists of omega m's for m greater than zero and omega hat m with m greater than minus one. The duality conditions is essentially the same as before, except we can only impose it for m greater than zero. But otherwise, it's the same thing, just a dual basis. But we don't have this condition that the derivative on the first operator is zero. An example of these functionals is for a equal to one. Again, they are like Legendre, they contain Legendre polynomials. But if you plug in m equal to zero to this equation, you'll find that h of zero is zero. So in other words, there is one functional missing. But still, this is a complete basis of the, it's just a different basis than the one before, than the permanent one. You can use this basis to study deformation. So let's now expand to the second order. At the leading order, we just have the 2a plus 2n, the double trace operators. And we are expanding the dimension and an OP equation to the second order, again, assuming that no new operators appear in the OPE. And because now one function is missing, a one parameter deformation is allowed. So let's parameterize this deformation by the anomalous dimension of the first operator, of the phi squared operator.
Let's define. I'm being a basis.
Yeah, well, it's a
basis or is it?
No, I'm talking about the basis for the dual space. I had the space of f's, generated by f's, and there is a space of functionals, and I just constructed two different bases for the dual space. One was the fermionic one, and the other one was the bosonic one. In the fermionic one, there was a sort of a complete one-to-one correspondence between the vectors which appear in the solution to crossing and the functionals. In this case, there is no such a correspondence because there is sort of one fewer functional than there are vectors in the solution. But there is no functional corresponding to phi squared. Yeah, I mean, of course, you're comparing two infinite sets, so you can't really say, oh, there is one fewer than here. There are two infinite sets, but. Yeah, the point is what I was saying on a previous slide, that there is no functional which would have double zeros everywhere except for one operator in the generalized free scalar spectrum. All the functionals have two simple zeros. So when I draw the... Yeah, I should have... four, but... Right, all the... For example, among the free boson functionals, there is going to be... This is the spectrum, 2a plus 2. 2a plus 4. So the simplest function which I can draw here is one which has a simple zero here and a simple zero here and then double zeros everywhere else. I don't have a functional which I had for the free fermion that would look like this. Like for the free fermion, I had a functional that had only one simple zero. If I apply this functional to a deformation, I find that there is no anomalous dimension. If I apply this functional to the deformation, I find that there is a linear equation between anomalous dimension here and anomalous dimension here. Right? So because I have sort of one less functional, I have one more parameter, which is precisely, which is this parameter g.
So missing functionals sometimes would be your creativity in finding functionals, or it could be that there is some physics that the functional does not exist.
It doesn't exist because you can take the functionals which I constructed, all those ones all the bosonic functions which I described on the previous slide, and you can show that they're complete. You can show there can't be anything else. I can tell you later how one can prove that, but it's a bit technical. Okay, so at the leading order in the perturbation, we apply these functionals, expand to the first order in G, and we find, well, the anomalous dimensions are just given by the derivative of the important part is the derivative of omega at the phi squared operator. And you'll find this formula. You can find a closed formula for what the anomalous dimensions in this deformation are. You can find a closed formula for the OP coefficients. And then you can check that, well, what you find is you just rediscovered the three-level contact interaction. So the only deformation of the free boson which doesn't introduce new operators, at a leading order is just the phi to the 4. It's the only UV complete leading order deformation or the four-point function of a free massive scalar in ADS. This was also found in more than one dimension using different methods by these gentlemen. But now you can go to higher orders. You can show that using this technique of dysfunctionals, once you've determined all the CFT data at order g to the k, you can apply omega n or omega hat n to find the next order data for the nth operator. So here are some results. You'll start finding zeta threes of higher transcendental numbers. So to my knowledge, this is the first time that that things like zeta 3 or zeta 4 have been derived from the conformal bootstrap. So in a way, you can think of this as being the reason why these kinds of numbers appear in perturbative computations in quantum field theory. In perturbative quantum field theory, people have to work a lot, computing many Feynman diagrams, summing many Feynman diagrams, and at the end they get some number involving a zeta or who knows what. And here it comes completely naturally. You just have an omega as a function of delta, which contains gamma function. It contains some polygammas. So all these zetas they just appear almost immediately. So this here is a result at a leading order, disconnected. This is the result at tree level for the contact diagram, and this is the result at one loop. So the g squared is like one loop in ADS. And indeed, you can check that you reproduce one-loop results in ADS, which was already done in more than one dimension by other people. But in this case, there is nothing that can stop you from going to higher loops, actually. And we computed using these functionals the result at g to the 3, which in ADS language corresponds to two loops. And then you just find transcendental phi. So all of this assumes that there are no new operators appearing in the OPE. Which is sort of an interesting constraint. It sounds a bit like integrability, because in integrable theories, when you scatter two particles, which is essentially what's happening here, you don't produce more than two particles. So somehow a natural guess is that what we are constructing is an integrable theory of a single real scalar field, which is integrable in ADS, which doesn't produce particles. So it sounds like a lot like this could be the Sinch or Sine Gordon theory in ADS background. But actually, it's not. I computed the particle production or the OPE of two phis and looked if there is this analog of particle production, and there is. The particle production is suppressed in the flat space limit, but at a finite radius, there actually is. So this theory this supposedly existing theory, it could still be that somehow this procedure will fail at some loop order and the theory actually doesn't exist. But
it still be support line, meaning that the cap, once the couple into the curvature, it produces particles.
No, but by producing particles, I mean that the OP of phi and phi only contains double trace like operators. You can, well, I took Sinch Gordon, coupled it to curvature, and found that in the OP of phi and phi, there are double traces, but there are also quadruple traces. Okay. Yeah, the quadruple traces are suppressed in the flat space limit, but
is the coupling unique?
Good question. I think it is, but what I suspect is that this theory must be some non-local deformation of the Sinch Gordon ADS. That somehow there must be some infinite powers of higher derivative couplings, maybe, which appear away from the flat space limit, which make the particle production disappear. Yeah, but anyway, this is an open-ended problem. We can discuss it maybe later, what this theory could be.
So G is a mass in ADS units.
G?
G.
G is a dimensionless parameter. It's like it's a phi to the 4 coupling at the leading order. Okay, you can also use this, to compute with an exchange diagram. And this also gives a lot of intuition for what these functionals actually are. So let's now drop this assumption that we are not introducing new operators, and let's introduce in the OP a new sort of single trace-like operator of some general dimension delta, and the OP coefficient, which is parametrically small, square root of g. So then crossing symmetry will imply for you that, well, this can be the whole story. We just inserted a new conformal block. The conformal block is not crossing symmetric. So the double trace operators must get some anomalous dimensions and anomalous OP coefficients. In other words, the first order correction to the four-point function looks like this. It contains this operator, the conformal block corresponding to this new single trace operator, but it also includes corrections to double traces. So these we have a sum over n, summing over all the double traces. This is a correction to the OP coefficient, and this is a correction to the scaling dimension. So it comes with a partial G, or partial, remember, is the derivative with respect to the scaling dimension. The bulk expectation is that crossing should completely fix lambda and gamma to correspond to the crossing symmetric combination of free level with an exchange diagram. Very good. This is the only thing that can happen in ADS, which is going to produce for you at leading order such a conformal block. So the conformal block is coming only from this diagram, and this diagram and the other two contribute to the corrections to the OP coefficients and double traces. And this problem was studied by Aldeibitz and Perlmutter in four dimensions using crossing, so using the same philosophy, but using tools which are not available in 1D. Okay, so we have this original problem. So let me go for it. So we have the problem of finding lambdas and gammas consistent with the fact that G is crossing symmetric. And there is essentially a unique answer up to contact diagrams. So let's first implement crossing. Crossing now reads that, well, there is this f of delta coming from the exchanged operator. And there are these corrections. Well, I forgot to say that lambda and gamma will in general depend on the exchange dimension, delta. And now once we apply omega and omega hat, we receive two contributions. We apply, omega, of course, is linear, so it acts on this f.
So lambda is missing, multiplying the first f now.
Sorry, where is lambda missing?
The three-point function for that guy.
For this guy?
Yes.
No, because I'm canceling g. I'm just expanding the four-point function at order g. This is the crossing. This is the crossing at order g. In other words, the OP coefficient is just g, and it's factored out. So I apply omega to this f. I find a contribution from here. And then when omega acts on this whole sum, it only receives contribution from one term. So when omega acts, it kills all of these terms because it vanishes on the spectrum. And it only receives contribution from one summand over here, which is the nth one. In other words, we find this equation that the anomalous dimension of the nth operator is precisely fixed to be the action of this unique function omega n, and the same thing for corrections to OP coefficients and omega. Of course, the whole thing is valid up to the contact interaction, because this contact interaction that we had before is just like this. It's just an ambiguity of the problem. In other words, that there is a physical interpretation of these functions omega of delta and omega hat of delta. These functions are equal to minus the corrections to the scaling dimension OP coefficients of double trace operators in a tree-level exchange of an operator of dimension delta. So this is like one physical interpretation of what these functions are doing. This is related to an observation which I don't have much time to explain, but there appeared another approach to conformal bootstrap. Led by Gopa Kumar and collaborators, which uses, instead of conformal blocks, uses sort of crossing symmetric block. But their approach, at least in 1D, can be completely derived from the standard approach by using these functions. So somehow this approach using crossing symmetric blocks is equivalent to expressing the crossing equation in the basis of the function which I constructed, omega n and omega hat of n. And this also clearly hints to us how to generalize this procedure to higher D. So somehow, in higher D, there should again be a complete basis of functions for the conformal bootstrap equation, where the basis elements are one-to-one correspondence with double trace operators in higher D. So now double trace operators are parameterized by the n, like the number of Laplacians, and the spin as well. And for each of them, you'll find two functionals. So these will be the equations which the Gopa Kumar's group was imposing. Okay, so just a few words about conclusions and outlook. So one of the main upshots is that we found a complete basis for the 1D conformal bootstrap equation, where the basis, two different bases actually, both of which consist of extremal-like functionals. These bases can be used to see how a conformal block in a cross-channel influences the directional CFT data, which is the same thing as computing the computing within exchange diagrams. And these functionals can also be used to compute higher loop, higher loop Feynman diagrams in ADS too. I also described an hopefully interesting integrable deformation of the free scalar in ADS2. It would be interesting to understand what is its relation to Stein-Gordon. It exists actually at a finite coupling, because I constructed it just perturbatively. I think for future development of this approach, it will be very important to understand really the origin of those kernels. I described some complicated system of functional equations, which can be solved. But clearly, these solutions are coming from somewhere. They must be coming from some complete set of wave functions for the ADS2 problem. But we don't really have a concrete proposal. We have more or less understood what is the relationship of this to the Karan-Ward formula and to the Poliakov bootstrap, even though I didn't have time to talk about it much. And of course, the main question is how to generalize this to higher D, where there is actually a hope of learning interesting things about interacting CFTs. So thank you. Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, it looks like they could be related to the discrete series, at least in some cases. Yeah, like for example, yeah. When the external dimension is specific, say one, then the double trace operator's dimensions are precisely the dimensions in the discrete series. So it looks like everything should be traced in terms of that. But then the discrete series doesn't contain all the, it's not a complete set of representations. Well, it is tied to the relationship to the Karan-Ward formula, because there is a Karan-Ward formula for the discrete series in one dimension, and in that case we find a complete match. You can sort of explain what we are finding using the Karan-Ward formula. I can tell you more about it. It might not be the whole. It's probably not the whole story. The discrete series is probably not enough.
Maybe if you turn on phi to the fourth in the free scalar, you'll land in the Ising model. But we introduce kind of free fermions. Do you think it's possible to do this flow?
Yeah. I mean, it looks a bit like that. It's
right.
So I mean, yeah. You turn on phi to the four, and now suddenly all the double traces acquire some anomalous dimension, and they can go up. So what you need for them is to go from 2a plus even integers to 2a plus odd integers, because there's a free fermion. Even though the phi, it can't be so simple, because the phi of the phi to the fourth theory does not become psi of the free fermion. So it's probably a bit more subtle. But yes, I can. It's super interesting to just ask where does this flow lead.
Can you like the Fashel equations somehow, numerically at least?
Yeah. There are infinitely many of them, because there are infinitely many operators, but it is a dynamical system. The equations that I'm solving here analytically that give us the zetas, they're just a dynamical system, a first-order dynamical system on the space of scaling dimensions and OP coefficients.
Okay.